the challenge to me, and what I wake up and gets me through the day, honestly, is, you know, how much more there is to learn, how little I know, you know, how unsure I should be, and, you know, the excitement of figuring things out.
Hello, and welcome back, or welcome to, the Gestalt Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler White. In this interview, we get a chance to chat with Steve Osterer. Steve is the founder of the Baseball Development Group, he's the author of the Baseball Recovery Resource, and he's a chiropractor by trade that specializes in baseball. Steve will be one of our presenters this year at the World Pitching Congress. Now, let's get to know more about Steve. Steve, what's going on?
Not a whole lot, man. just getting by.
Yes, that is a very accurate response. Getting by. What's Canada like right now?
Well, it's raining today. It's been pretty warm, actually. So, you know, we have a pretty moderate winter, I would say, relative to what you probably think Canada is.
It's not tundra all the time. Like,
no, I'm not shoveling snow 6 months a year. So yeah, it's been pretty warm, like 75 degrees, you know, 80 degrees last month. So, weather's pretty good. Guys are still playing fall ball. They wrap up in high school guys at, you know, 2-3 weeks. So they run it through, you know, mid October, and, the weather actually kind of holds up pretty well for the most part. Maybe the last week is rough, but overall it's still baseball weather up here.
That is perfect. I like fall baseball so much better than spring baseball. I mean, you get the end of like the good weather. It's not freezing at the point where you hate life. Like fastball inside and you break your thumbs and you got to deal with that for 2 months. That's not like even in St. Louis, I dread fall or early spring baseball. Dread it. Like at the end of February, beginning of March, nightmare.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what you guys are dealing with.
Yeah, well, you know what though? Like our fall ball season is, you know, it's September, October. It's condensed, but the actual season doesn't really kind of get going until May. So, you know, fall ball is still fall ball because it happens in the fall. But you know, you're only looking at your fifth and maybe sixth month of baseball. It's not that extended, right? So, yeah, I think it's a little bit different in that regard. But, you know, I loved it. I loved it as a player. Like I got a little bit of it in high school. Yeah, but the weather was kind of a little bit nicer. It's really humid up here in the summer.
I like that schedule better. Like May to October. That's perfect. Instead of like down here where it's, you know, February to say April, May, and then you take a week off and then you got summer ball from May to August. And then you take a week off and then you go September to the beginning of November or some stupid stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a long time.
It's not fun.
That's a lot. That's a lot of baseball.
I can remember when I was in sixth grade playing like 75 games in a summer. And I was like, that's too much. That's way too much.
That's a lot. That's a lot of games.
It's funny because I imagine everyone up in Canada wears like big like wolf pelts every time they go outside just from the harsh tundra weather. So... It's nice to hear you guys can like enjoy the weather.
Yeah, it's definitely not like that at all. Maybe you should come up one time.
I've been to Windsor once.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So yeah. Sure.
So I saw what Canada truly is.
That's it. Exactly. Good depiction of it.
Let's get into this a little bit. Okay. So chiropractor by trade. You and I actually bumped into each other, unbeknownst to each of us, back in chiropractic school. An event called Cairo Games, which is just a reason to go to Cocoa Beach for a weekend and drink. Yeah, that was super interesting. You played hockey though. You didn't play softball.
No, just hockey. That was a big event for us, for our chiropractic school up here, is going down there and putting together a little hockey team, to beat up on the American boys.
I'm pretty sure it was an absolute like slaughtering every single game.
Yeah, for sure. We stayed totally hydrated. lots of water, lots of fluids on the bench. You know, definitely put our heart and soul into it. So, great times though. Oh, yeah, man. those are fun times.
Nothing like a weekend to totally destroy everything you learned over the last year, and that's kind of what it did.
Yeah, sure.
Oh my gosh. So give me, let's talk a little bit geographically. Where are you at? Where's baseball development group, location wise? Where are you from? Let's get into that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Ottawa, which is about a 4-hour drive away from Toronto. Ottawa is not, the biggest baseball city in the world. We typically don't have much for winter baseball, for training. I didn't do anything in the winter pretty much my entire life. So, grew up basically, thinking I was going to be a hockey player. And
is that every kid in Canada? Just
yeah,
curious.
Yeah, pretty much.
Kind of.
And then basically the way that kind of hockey goes up there is – yeah, when you're 16, 17, you kind of figure out, whether you're going to be late to the party, playing hockey down south, or, you're not good enough. And I was one of those guys who probably would have gone when I was 19, would have been one of those older guys. And, at the time, I was still playing baseball, got lucky, got found somehow in some random park in Montreal. And, it set off a chain of events that eventually got me to play college baseball instead of hockey. But yeah, I mean, baseball, for me was always kind of a secondary thing growing up. In Ottawa, it's it is a hockey town. Baseball again, like it was a lot of fun, but not on the top of my mind necessarily growing up. Eventually, I like I said, I got kind of seen. I hurt myself, and I guess I'm going back into my backstory a little bit here. I might as well, but
go for it.
So I got recruited or got seen. Was going to go to Cornell to play. I messed around with weighted baseballs, way back when. This was like 2003, and gained a couple ticks of miles an hour, pretty quickly. Ended up hurting my elbow. And couldn't throw at all, so I kind of got bounced around, from specialist to specialist, in Ottawa. Spent about 4 or 5 months, something like that, getting treated and going through conventional routes, and still couldn't throw a ball. And
real quick, what were those treatments like? 4 months of treatment, 4 or 5 months of treatment?
Yeah, so I mean, it was a lot of. A lot of stuff directed, specifically at the elbow and the forearm. So, a lot of we did a lot of like Graston type stuff. We did some manual therapy on the elbow. We did a lot of, your typical return to throwing rehab stuff for the elbows. So, we built things back up, and they took their time with it. But, I literally couldn't throw a ball 20 feet without pain. So they'd try something else. And I got to a point where, I was lucky enough to get into, see the orthopedic surgeon for the Blue Jays at the time. And within maybe 10 minutes of her examining me, she, after, looking at my MRI and everything, she sent me to the chiropractor for the Blue Jays. And the chiropractor for the Blue Jays did a little bit of ART and acupuncture on my lat and my shoulder. And sent me back to Ottawa to someone that he, he thought could, carry on similar treatment style. And it worked. About 3-4 weeks later, I was able to throw a little bit. And I think within 2-3 months, I was able to throw completely pain-free. Never had really anything in my elbow again. I guess that put something in the back of my mind, it almost incepted me, I guess you could say, that there's something a little bit different about chiropractic, and maybe that was an avenue that I wanted to pursue. So, to kind of get back to, how that leads back to Toronto, I went to school and was healthy for 4 years and decided to be a chiropractor. And there's really only one English speaking chiropractic school in Canada, and that's in Toronto. So, I went to school here, stuck around here, and then eventually opened up BDG, which is, a training facility, about 25 minutes east of actual Toronto in Scarborough. So, those are some of the events that kind of led me to here, and we've been here for a couple of years now. We're coming up on our third year at this facility, actually.
That's going back real quick to kind of becoming a chiropractor and having that change of like understanding. Not just chasing the pain, but finding where the real side of the problem was. Do you ever like hesitate or don't feel too confident when people ask what you do for a living?
No, I don't actually.
Okay.
I don't. Yeah. We kind of don't have that vibe around here.
You're fortunate.
So, yeah. You know what? It's, maybe a little bit, but you know, for the most part, at least in Toronto, because it's close to the chiropractic school, we breed a lot. And, I mean, the school itself is, it's a really good school. You know, it's very much, you know, based off of whatever evidence base we can come up with for chiropractic. But, you know, there's a lot of adjunct stuff that, you know, they expose you to, a lot of seminars, a lot of continuing education that runs through there. And, you know, the city of Toronto and the quality of chiropractic care that comes out of here is pretty good. You know, we're considered a primary healthcare practitioner. So, you know, people come to us for, you know, a lot of different things. We're a first point of contact for people. So, you know, the reputation that we have here, maybe it's a little bit different, you know, depending on where you are in the States.
Hmm.
But I'm never hesitant to say what, you know, what I do or, you know, what my, you know, licensing is in at all. You know, you do have to educate parents and educate people a little bit, no matter what. I mean, I think that happens regardless of what you do, but, you know, I'm pretty proud to be a chiropractor. You know, I may not be a chiropractor in, you know, the strictest sense of, you know, some people's philosophies. You know, we do have a lot of different, slightly different philosophies, not necessarily you and I, but the profession itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I may not be a chiropractor the same way someone down the street is a chiropractor necessarily, but yeah, within the scope of what I'm able to do, I'm pretty proud to, you know, to be in this profession. You know, and like I said, I think that was, you know, instilled in me because it changed my life when I was in high school. And, you know, I like to think that I'm, you know, trying to do something similar. I think that's, you know, obviously a big reason why I'm doing what I'm doing is to, you know, to help someone like me, and maybe prevent, you know, the frustration and the experience that I went through, you know, in thinking that I was going to go to a great school and play baseball to, you know, maybe I'm never going to throw a ball again. So yeah, I guess that's, you know, that's something that I'm proud of. My sister, I have an older sister, is actually a chiropractor as well. So, you know, we're a chiropractic family, which is an interesting thing. So
that's pretty cool. No, that's actually really, yeah. I really like that you have that kind of mentality and that idea, and that it's so progressive in Toronto and in that area. The hard part about it over here, like Logan's a great school and there's a lot of good chiropractors over here, but the problem is there's so many different, subtypes, I should say, where people do things that makes me just beat my head against a wall. And the problem is a lot of times these are the most vocal that get seen on YouTube or get heard about. And then immediately the masses are like, oh, that's what you do. I'm like, no, not even in the same, you know, that is the reason why I'm like, a lot of times I'll preface, like, I'm more of like a movement specialist, and I hate to kind of like take away from, you know, what like chiropractic is going to, but I always say it's more of like a physical therapy chiropractic hybrid. Like it's muscle technique type stuff as far as like myofascial release. And although chiropractors are really good at adjusting joints, like there's much more to it than just freeing up range of motion. And then, you know, we get into like the stabilization component and all the other little, you know, nuances of movement. People think, oh, you're gonna like, I'm not going to dish on anybody or, you know, talk crap on anybody right now, but there are certain methods that people charge money for, and for conditions that I'm like, what are you doing? There's next to no evidence that any of this is plausible. And then I have to bear the brunt of it. So that's, to me, that's frustrating. But anyway,
sounds like you love this profession.
I do, in the sense that, you know, worked hard to get this degree and all that, and it the licensing gives me the vehicle to do all the things I want to do, because I had a similar experience, not being able to throw, saw somebody did some, you know, work to get me going again, and I was like, I could do this, like that was really neat. And that's what I'm using it for. Now, going through the process, I didn't realize there were so many evangelists And that's the part that I was like, you got so many people trying to give you free pizza to get you to join their group, and then all of a sudden you're doing some crazy technique that very few people should be publicly talking about. But that's neither here nor there. That's not what we're talking about today. Look at
Let's
me getting
move
off
on.
my soapbox. Jeez. Oh my God. All right. Anyway, back to more important stuff. Who do you look to for influence, like in your professional career or personal, like just anything?
I guess my background, I so when I was in chiropractic school, I had this desire, I think the whole time, to obviously become a chiropractor, but to focus my studies on baseball.
You and
So
me both, brother.
I yeah, I mean, I was looking at cases and trying to relate them to baseball pretty much every day. But part of that process was aligning with sports chiropractors up here, ones who had particular interest in baseball. And there's a lot of them, surprisingly. So, I had a couple people like Dr. Andrew Robb, who did a study with Fleissig as part of his sports chiropractic residency, which is pretty cool. And Dr. Michael Chivers, who kind of led me into the functional anatomy seminars, or functional range seminars, I guess they're called now. So the FRC, FRA, FR release, those courses were, a big influence on me and shaping my perspective on, how I assess, how I treat, more so how I conceptualize, what I do. They did a really good job, and they still do a really good job, obviously, of trying to answer questions, with some sort of rationale. So, I took all the ART courses, I think, before taking the FR courses. So I took them really early on. And one of the things that I always sat there and thought to myself was, well, what's the actual science behind this? Like, what's going on? And FR did a really good job of explaining that. So they got into details, and they really taught me how to be more critical and be, more on my guard in terms of, understanding the basics and understanding, answering and addressing basic physiology, and just trying to, have some sort of rationale for what I do. And I think that lens is kind of stuck with me, over the last 4 or 5 years, since graduating. I mean, those are my, I guess, my underpinnings, of how I see things and kind of what influenced me. And I think since graduating, the biggest thing has been, really, outside of continuing education, it's really been just conversations with peers and professionals. So, I wouldn't say I'm influenced necessarily by one specific or two specific people, but I'm influenced, not daily, but weekly for sure, with conversations like I have with you, maybe once a month. Guys like Eugene Bleeker, I speak to, once a month. It's I've got, a group of people, I guess, that we have frequent conversations, and I try to get as much as I can out of them, and pick their brains, and read what they're reading, but at the same time go about my own ways. I wouldn't say I specifically have one thing influencing me. It's more of a network, and a network of like-minded, growth-minded, baseball peers, I should say.
Yeah, that's actually that's a really good answer. Just because that's I completely agree with everything there. Like there are certain people that kind of dictate a little bit of your direction of how you see the world. But having a group, a network to throw ideas off of, whether good or bad or they agree or disagree, is really important. So you actually were an assistant instructor for FR, right?
Briefly.
Briefly, tell me about that a little bit.
I helped out with a couple of courses. you know, it's just helping with the more with the practical side of things than anything else. You know, with FR, there's a lot of technical stuff. You know, the technique itself is, you know, it's obviously its own thing. It's different than other courses. So, you know, there's a lot of time focused specifically to that and the palpation itself. And, you know, I think that's a skill that, you know, I know, you know, the reason the course actually started was because it wasn't well taught up here. So we had, you know, essentially graduating a class of chiropractors, you know, every year that, you know, the palpation was probably a little suspect, the way we were taught it. So, you know, to me, you know, not just palpating what you're, you know, knowing what you're palpating, but, you know, to identify kind of what you're palpating from a feel perspective, you know? So usually when you start, like, you would know, you got pretty foggy hands and you're just kind of like thumping on things and pressing around and you're not really, attuned to what you're feeling, to tension, to, you know, abnormalities or, you know, anything like that. So, you know, the technical component to it was, you know, unbelievably helpful at the time, and still is. You know, I still review that stuff. I think it's really important. But yeah, I think the big thing that FR, and I always tell people this, the biggest thing that FR taught me was to be in the moment with the tissue and be in the moment with your hands. And, you know, just like anything else, you know, haptic perception, it's a sense and it's a skill. And, you know, with any skill, you need to have deliberate practice. So, you know, as a student and you know, someone who was learning that stuff at the beginning, I wasn't very good at it, obviously. So, you know, you kind of just like poke around and you're not really, really, really deliberately practicing, you know, the way probably you need to be. So, you know, every one of those courses, whether you're teaching or you know, you're taking it, there's, you know, tens of hours of deliberate practice on palpation itself and feeling. And, you know, that to me is kind of what it's all about. If you're a manual therapist, is to really be, you know, in tune with what you're doing. You know, there's obviously a component to it where, you know, you have to have some bedside manner and you have to actually converse with the patient and you know, they're not just, you know, a piece of tissue on the table. Right. You know, and there's a skill in that and still being able to feel what you're trying to feel. But, you know, if you're just kind of poking around and you're not, you know, trying to address a specific outcome with your hands and, you know, you're really just kind of mushing things around. And, yeah, I don't know necessarily if I believe that's the best course of action when you're treating people.
Just a piece of tissue on the table. That's true. The quote I'm going to use for your intro. FR is a lot of, they have a lot of fascial kind of background to their teachings, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Now, go ahead.
Yeah. No, sorry. Go. You're good.
I was going to kind of just expound on that a little bit. So have you taken like an FDM fascial distortion model or like a stucco course?
I've never taken them formally. I've only read their books and their course manuscripts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if I should admit that.
Edit.
Yeah. Actually, I might've gotten both of them from you. So now you're in this with me.
There we go. Yeah. What, so how much congruency is there between all three or at least some with FR? Because you know FR a lot better and you've kind of at least seen some of the other stuff.
I think it's there's congruency for sure. You know, at least with an understanding of, you know, what fascia is and what connective tissue is, and potentially how you may be affecting it. You know, there's a little deviation away from that because we don't really know necessarily what we're doing with our hands. So there is some, you know, extrapolation from the limited resources we have, research we have to come up with, you know, your technique for doing it. But, you know, as a whole, I don't think, you know, any of those are too far away from each other. There are similarities, but, you know, I can't speak to, you know, FDM or the Stecco method, you know, with too much depth or, Yeah, because I've never taken either of those. So it's just from me, reading their stuff.
Yeah. Interesting. No, we've kind of, went back and forth on the concepts of fashion manipulation and kind of the role. And you're right. No one knows. No one really knows. I mean, we have some research that's coming out, but like right now it's such a basis of theory. And right. Regardless of, theory is one thing and, valid research is another, but still results also make a big difference. So if you're getting results, regardless of whether or not it's been validated or, has been proven to be true, it doesn't neglect or it doesn't take away from it. So that is kind of one concept to be aware of on that end, I guess.
Yeah.
So let's go into the landscape of Canadian baseball. We talked a little bit before we started, just kind of where we're at, what's going on. I want to hear from the horse's mouth. What's Canadian baseball like?
Man. Well, I mean, we deal obviously, primarily with Ontario baseball. Canadian baseball as a whole is a little bit harder for me to make a grand sweeping statement on, I guess. But, there's recently, just a couple weeks ago, every year now they have this thing called Tournament 12 or T12, where they bring in the best players from across the country, high school players, together to participate, in a week of games. And, it's heavily scouted. It really is the best of the best kids. And, you're just putting on display for everyone, what Canadian baseball is. It's growing. Baseball in Canada is growing. It's, there's been a few breakthroughs this year in terms of players that younger guys coming up, like Mike Soroka is a really good example of that.
Crushing it.
Yeah. He's crushing it. And, he pitched in the first T12 or one of the first two of them. Josh Naylor's another guy, young guy who's done pretty well this year. And, baseball, itself is growing as a game up here. We're producing some high end talent. We're producing slightly more college players, than we have in the past. But, I think a big struggle with, growing the game here, at least, obviously, being in Canada, it's tough. It's tough to get exposure. It really is. You have to pay a lot of money to, get down to good tournaments. Otherwise, you're just playing the same kids in Ontario, at least for the Ontario teams. So, there's a handful of travel teams that, are pretty decent. They've got some good players, but, it's I don't want to use the term watered down. That might not be the right term, but for them to play against each other, the talent level isn't high enough for exposure to come up to watch necessarily for college teams, at least, that, you got to go down south, and to do so requires a lot of money. It's not a cheap sport to play up here. It's actually, it comes close, depending on the kid and the team and the organization. It can come close to hockey, and hockey is obviously bananas, in Toronto. Yeah, like completely out of control. But, it can be a very expensive sport. So I think that is a limiting factor for kids when they get to, 14, 15. Money starts to come into play where you got to spend, 10 to 15, upwards of $20,000 a year to play on one of these elite teams. That's a battle that we face in our facility because we don't have a team. So, anyone who's coming to us is paying out of pocket on top of that. So it's obviously hard for us to, charge any sort of money. I grew up playing baseball for like $500 for a year. And, it's hard for me, and this probably makes me a really bad business person, but it is hard for me to justify charging people, what we're actually worth. And we don't, but, charging them any sort of money, when they're already spending a lot, players are coming to us cause they're not getting, what they need out of their team or their organization. And, they have to pay out of pocket for that, which is, unfortunate. But that's kind of what baseball in Canada is, it's, It's growing. It's getting better. You know, the teams and the organizations are getting better at development. But as a whole, there's still some very obvious barriers to, you know, kids moving beyond just playing high school baseball up here. You know, the other thing is obviously the American dollar kills us. So, you know, if you're paying, you know, a modest, amount for, you know, tuition to play down south and have the opportunity to play college baseball, you know, you got to multiply that by 1.3 to, you know, you know, put it into Canadian dollars. So, and that's not including travel expenses, right? So, you know, for parents to drive down or to fly down and see their kids, like it becomes a really expensive thing for a lot of these kids to go play college baseball. So, you know, what we've seen in the last few years is a few kids, you know, pretty decent players deciding just to stay up here. And we've seen, you know, every year we see it, but, you know, players who went down there for a year didn't like what they were doing and thought it was too much money, realized that it wasn't what they thought it was, and then coming back and playing in one of the, you know, the Ontario universities, which the baseball of that is actually getting a lot better. You know, for the first time in quite a few years, there's a pitcher signed by the Toronto Blue Jays out of Canadian University, and he did actually pretty decent out of you know, the Vancouver Canadiens team. And you know, there's a couple players in that league right now who are potentially going to do the same thing. So, yeah, we are shifting maybe a little bit away from playing American college baseball. Maybe we're taking steps towards that just because the barriers are so high. And, you know, if you spend a lot of money as a parent and as a, you know, family trying to get to play college baseball, you know, tens of thousands of dollars before you even step foot on American soil, and then have to pay another, you know, 20, 25, 30 per year, it becomes a really big burden. So, you know, things, like I said, things are getting better. I don't want to make it too bleak, but things are getting better. The game is growing up here. You know, guys like Soroka are inspiring young kids. You know, we see Atlanta Braves shirts in here all the time, actually. So, which is really cool. It is. But, you know, there's some obvious obstacles and barriers that we face that I think are a little unique to where we are.
I can't imagine there's too many places like what you guys are doing with development in the Toronto area or just Canada in that of itself, maybe a handful.
Yeah, it's a small amount. You know, the way the high school game is set up here is, you know, the local stuff, you know, the people got away from that and started their own private travel teams. You know, they realized that the local games were getting you exposure, and this is years ago. So, you know, these elite travel teams popped up and, you know, you paid to get exposure to play in a different league and to go down south for tournaments and prioritize all that. And that turned into having your own training and having your own development system and having your own facility, right? So, you know, there's no high school baseball up here, really. High school baseball isn't a thing. So you're playing year round with a travel team, and that travel team, you know, every single one of them has their own facility. So with that facility comes, you know, having your development program and having your own instruction. So, you know, I wouldn't say that there's not necessarily, there's very few places that are development only and don't have a team. And we're one of them. And then there's, you know, a chunk of teams who have their development program within their own facility that, you know, they run everything through. So, yeah, it's, That could be a whole different conversation. I don't want to bore anyone with that, but I'll probably get way too fired up over it. But yeah, keep the ball rolling, man. Let's move on. Before I get
that. Yeah. No, but like to me, it's like, you know, I don't think enough people realize how important development is and just being a better athlete and just building your body up and making it more resilient and strong and powerful and explosive. And playing games doesn't necessarily translate to that. Now, it is important. You need to get in and refine what you're building, but more time should be spent in that realm of getting you, you know, I hate the term bigger, faster, stronger, but you get the idea. And with someone with like your background and what BDG is able to do, I can't imagine there's much in the entire, you know, Toronto area or Canada itself that has the capability of doing what you guys are able to do if you're interested in baseball, like if you want to become a good baseball player, like to me, it seems like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like you have more notoriety in the States than you do in Canada. Is that right or wrong?
I don't know. Probably.
And that's crazy to me.
But you know, in fairness, America is 10 times the size of Canada. So, you know, there's a larger population following and caring about baseball.
I agree.
I agree with you. I think when I look at teams and I think about development, you know, obviously, you know, you need to play games. But the reality of the situation is, you know, especially with these development, you know, teams and the number of Canadian kids up here, the exposure, obviously, this is a very common and very simple theme. Like, there's no point in getting exposure unless you've got something to show, right? There's no point going to a showcase unless you have something to showcase. Otherwise, you're just getting exposed. And you know, directing all of your resources as a player, you know, not all, but a large chunk of them to get better at those specific things that people are looking for. And that does include playing games, but it includes, you know, being faster, throwing the ball harder, hitting the ball further, you know, being able to move better, and be more athletic. All of those things are what going to get you past high school in Canada. You know, so for me, the majority of resources should go towards that. And, you know, that's why our facility will never have a team. You know, I don't think you need a team to go play college baseball. You need a team to play a little bit. That's fine. But you can play locally and go to a showcase or a school, and if you're good enough, they'll take you. And we've, you know, we've seen that recently. We've had a few kids come through here, and this is going to happen now. This, you know, this winter will be a new thing for us. But, you know, we have about 10 kids who have decided to ditch playing in Canada, and they're just going to train, you know, pretty much until their season starts, and then play for an elite travel team in the States. They'll play in 5 or 6 tournaments, some exhibition stuff, and that's it. So they'll get into really good tournaments. They're just going to train, focus entirely on training, and get better at what they need to get better at, and then go get exposure. And that's it's a drastically different approach to, you know, what is conventionally done up here. But yeah, we're getting a lot of flack for it. But listen, if we're talking about $10,000-$15,000 to do, you know, the conventional method, and we're talking about $5,000-$6,000 to do what we're doing and focus all or most of your resources to getting better at what you need to get better at, I mean, what are we talking about here? No. So the development thing is really interesting. It's really, really interesting because, you know, people are paying to be on a team and go play, you know, in big tournaments, and that's great. But, you know, they're also under the illusion that playing in these tournaments, you know, means that they're a super elite player and they're going to get a scholarship because they're in those tournaments. But, you know, we know that's not the case at all. You know, you got to have some sort of talent, and you have to have some tangible numbers to back it up. So, I just went on a bit of a rant. But,
we can step away from the political landscape of Canadian baseball.
Let's get away from Canadian baseball.
So sorry. You're all worked up now. You have to go punch something.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
So I want to talk a little bit about like a translation of movement. So Canada, hockey's huge. You know, you've got Slapshot. How much do you see in like a slap shot translates into throwing or hitting a baseball as far as cross pattern activation?
Probably not as much as you think. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting thing. And I've had this conversation with a few people, you know, about, you know, hockey players and baseball players. And, you know, there have been a few examples in the past of, you know, former major leaguers, Canadian guys who were avid hockey players growing up. And then it became this thing where, you know, every Canadian baseball player is this sweet swinging lefty. And, you know, they all hit bombs like Matt Stairs. And it's because they played hockey growing up. And I think the reality of the situation is that's not the case. the really, really, really good hockey players up here stay as hockey players. And yeah, it's not a shot at Canadian baseball players at all. It's just a reality of the situation. If you're a super elite hockey player in Canada, there is a very good chance that you're going to be a professional hockey player. And you know that when you're 14. So, you know, when you're 14 and up here and you're making a choice between hockey and baseball, and it's even, you know, kind of up in the air, you're probably not going to be choosing hockey. And you're probably going to be, because you're a good athlete and you're a super elite hockey player, or you're elite enough to play in the elite level of hockey here, you're probably a really good athlete, and you're going to be a good baseball player. So you're going to stick with baseball. So it's not necessarily that, you know, we're growing these guys who have, you know, 100 mile an hour plus slap shots, and it's translating to hitting. I think it's just this narrative that, you know, we're a hockey country. So do I think the pattern helps? Yeah, for sure it does help. For sure it does. But I haven't seen a strong correlation between, you know, really good hockey players and really good baseball players. One of the best hitting guys we've had in here, high school guys, second rounder, lefty hitter, catcher, and he didn't play a lick of hockey. So I remember talking to Eugene about this, and we were talking about it, and he's like, maybe it's because he, you know, he watched a lot of hockey growing up and he picked up the movement by watching guys. I'm like, maybe, but you know, maybe the more simpler answer is he's just a good athlete. And he's good at rotating, you know, so he's a good mover. And I think that's what it is. So, do they translate? I don't know. You know, I was a terrible hitter. I was a decent hockey player. Who knows?
Yeah. I had a similar conversation with a guy who's a strength and conditioning coach for the Stanley Cup champion St. Louis Blues, and he was, he, you know, we just had an interesting back and forth on the translations of, as far as like ground reaction force and using, you know, looseness and the ability to generate power through interior oblique sling and all that. And, you know, you're right. I do think that there is correlation. I don't think you have to have a big background in hockey to be good at that, and vice versa. Like, I remember watching, I forget who was what the dude's name was, but it was a first round pick 1 year. It was like a number one overall pick in a hockey draft. Go take batting practice before a game, and it was the most embarrassing. Was it Crosby?
No, he actually had bombs. I thought you were
going. No. This was the most embarrassing thing I've ever seen. I was like, oh man, he's a professional athlete. This is tough. And I thought for sure there would be some translation.
But. Well, yeah, I mean, there's going to be translation. I think that, you know, one of the big factors, again, that's different is, you know, you're on ice and you're on skates and, you know, you're still interacting with the ground, but the ground is, the interaction's a little bit different, and it is flat ground. So, you know, there is a definite skill to be able to control your body and control your center of mass and center of balance on skates that, is a little bit unique, right? So, yeah, I mean, if we're talking about taking a slap shot, you know, off the floor versus, you know, swinging on the floor, yes, there's some obvious carryover there. But you know, the game of hockey itself and playing on ice is it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so you pitched at Cornell, correct?
That's right.
Ivy League, which is why you're wearing an ascot right now and smoking a pipe. It's a podcast. People can't see. You just got to trust me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So what's changed? What's changed since you went through the college game?
In college baseball, in the Ivy League level?
Well, just college baseball in general.
Oh, man. I don't know. I mean, I actually just realized that I graduated 10 years ago, which is, I know it's pretty funny. Old man factor. I was walking around campus, cause we talked about this before we went on air, but, I helped out with some movement assessments for their baseball team. And, I looked at the assistant coach, and he was a teammate of mine. He was a freshman when I was a senior. And, I was like, man, I graduated 10 years ago. Holy shit. I'm old. I'm allowed to say that.
I used it on one of them. Yeah, you're good.
Yeah. So, I mean, in 10 years, things have changed, considerably. And, you know, back when, you know, when I was there and There was, you know, some development, obviously. There's, you know, a little bit of video review. I don't think Cornell baseball necessarily, no offense to Cornell baseball, 10 years ago, now they're doing a way better job. But 10 years ago, we weren't, you know, the beacon of innovation in player development. You know, it's a Ivy League baseball school. So, you know, the stuff that we did, you know, it was minimal. The emphasis was on, you know, more on being academically inclined than anything else. And yeah, I went back a few weeks ago, and everything is different now. There's a lot more tech. Everything is recorded. You know, they're actually doing data analysis, and you know. Things are different, and I think that's obviously widespread. You know that across the entire country. Obviously, much more and on a larger scale in the bigger schools. But yeah, there's a lot more emphasis on the development side of things and objectivity, and you know, trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work, and answering questions. So. Yeah, I think that's the obvious answer to that question. So I don't know. I think everyone said that 1,000 times. I don't have a different take on it, honestly.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. If you went through the whole process again, knowing what you know now, what would you do different?
As a player?
Yep.
I'd probably take it a lot more seriously. you know, when you have – yeah, I mean, and in fairness to – you know, us back then, you know, the player development wasn't a big thing, right? You came in to, you know, your school, and for us, it was, you know, get through Cornell, get a degree and move on. It wasn't, let's see how good at baseball we can get. We kind of knew, you know, in the first year, okay, well, like, you know, we are kind of at this level of talent. We might get a little bit better. We're probably not going to get so good that we're going to get drafted. If we're going to be a draft guy, we probably knew right away. And not a lot was going to change, especially as a pitcher. I didn't go in there and think I was going to, you know, it was even possible to gain 4 or 5 miles an hour and you know, exit there throwing 95, right? So, I would have taken it more seriously had I, you know, had everyone known that you can improve velocity, you can improve, you know, how much better you are at baseball, you can get objective feedback about what you're doing wrong and you know, how to get better at it and you know, see the results. So you know, for us, you know, we took a lot of pride in certain things, but you know, objectively getting better just wasn't a thing. So if I were, you know, injected into a program like that now, I would be all over it. I would be all over it because, you know, you can see that you're getting better. You know, it's a thing. That's the narrative around baseball now is you can actually get better. And I probably would have been as obsessed as I am now as someone on the other side of the ball, but you know, as a player.
It's funny because like playing in high school and in college, I used to think like, throwing harder, hitting like 90 or whatever, gaining 5 miles an hour, took like a secret elixir that no one really knew. And some people just lucked out. And now like actually being into it, it's like, oh, I get it. I understand this now.
Right.
Makes sense. Exactly. Biggest challenges for you day to day?
I think the biggest challenge that we face is trying to get a good handle of what guys are doing outside of our facility. So, like I said, every single player that comes through here is on a team, and because they're on a team, they have practices, they have, you know, mandatory things. Sometimes they're lifting, sometimes they're throwing, sometimes they're doing some of that at school. And you know, when we run groups, it's, you know, we intake information, you know, we do our wellness questionnaires. We obviously have conversations with each guy about what's going on, but, you know, it can be difficult with, you know, a lot of players and especially high school players getting exactly what's going on outside of our facility, and then kind of tuning how we, you know, stress them from day to day. So, you know, a lot of things are on the fly unnecessarily, but I think that's just a reality of you know, who we are and what we are. You know, not all of their baseball stuff comes you know, through our facility, so we don't have control of that. And We educate our players, but we still have, we had a guy last week come in and said, my arm's killing me. What happened? Well, I had a dodgeball finals and I had to show off. Well, that's great. That's great, man. Congratulations. I hope that worked out for you. But you know, it's, it, you know, that's the population you're dealing with when you're dealing with high school guys. It happens. I think, and that's the biggest challenge for us really is, you know, managing their stress because, you know, those guys are only in here 3 days a week. It's a lot of the rest of the week for them to do other things. So getting a handle on that and refining our process and you know, helping improve the education on that and getting, you know, guys to buy in on the importance of something like sleep. You know, those are challenges. Those are real challenges, day-to-day challenges. I think we talk a lot about the fancy stuff, especially on social media. But, you know, we neglect some of the, you know, lower hanging fruits that are maybe a little bit boring, like, you know, educating players on how important, you know, getting buy-in on it, on how important sleep is.
Hmm.
So
it's almost as if there was a book out there on recovery that people could read to understand how that process worked.
Yeah, I know, right? That'd be really convenient if there is a resource out there specifically dedicated to the recovery process and how it relates to baseball. I'd probably buy it, depending on the price, Canadian or American dollars, yeah.
Or Bitcoin. Let's go into that. Let's talk about that. So you wrote a book that I don't think enough people know about, correct?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
I don't like calling it a book. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I got 75 in English in high school and I never really I thought I'd be an author as my lowest grade.
It's a manual.
Yeah. So I think it's more of a resource than anything else. I don't know. It just sounds like, you know, less fraudulent, I guess, saying it's a resource than it is a book. But yeah, that, you know, we, you and I put it together. What is it? 2 years now, maybe three. You know what? I don't even remember. That's pretty bad. But I believe it was 2 years ago in April. Yeah, we launched that out there. And, you know, I think what I tend to see quite a bit of, and I still see it every day, is, you know, people struggling with the idea, just a conceptual idea of what recovery is. You know, we see it a lot now where we're trying to individualize training. We're individualizing our throwing drills, our warm-ups, our lifting, movement, mobility, and our recovery stuff. And a lot of what we're seeing in the recovery world in baseball still to this day is either completely unfounded in any sort of you know, scientific rationale, or is just kind of out there to be trendy and cool. So, you know, back when I started, you know, putting the book together, I think it really just started as a manual for our players. And then it just turned into, okay, well, like, I don't think anyone's actually talking about this at all, so why don't we put it out there? So, yeah, I mean, it went into, you know, some of the, you know, theoretical constructs of what recovery is, and, you know, some of the potential applications and the modalities and looking into the effectiveness of them, some of the research behind them, and yeah, just trying to help coaches build a better framework for, you know, managing workload and understanding what a recovery session or recovery work actually is. Because I still think it's, you know, it's probably really confusing for people. You know, by and large, you know, players are going through this expansive recovery routine immediately post-throwing that is not really founded on anything, you know, and it's become a hot topic outside of baseball as well with all the different modalities that are out there, and you could spend, you know, $2,000-$3,000 on all these different recovery modalities that are not proven by any stretch of, well, nothing's proven, but don't have a lot of support in the research for their effectiveness. So yeah, I think that, like I just said in a couple of minutes ago, the biggest thing that helps with recovery is sleep. Yet we, you know, we have everyone providing a discount code for, you know, a stim unit. And, like, you know, we have players buying into this idea that, you know, putting a stim unit on, for example, is going to solve their problems. You know, I'm going to throw a lot and then I'm going to put the stim unit on, then I'm going to go home and, you know, I'll play Fortnite till 2 a.m. And that makes me sound crusty, but
you are a little crusty. You've been at school too long.
But you know, maybe instead of spending $500 on something like that, why don't you just try and get 8 hours of sleep and eat better? I don't know. Yeah, the book itself was the book. I said it. It's there it your is. Fault. The resource itself was, you know, trying to help coaches, you know, build a better, you know, understanding of, you know, what maybe they should be doing for recovery work, which to me is probably not very much, if anything. You know, what does it mean? What are we trying to recover? Which is always a funny question. Well, what are you trying to recover with that? You know, so it was trying to just give some info on that. Not that I'm an expert at all, but I thought I, you know, there's really nothing out there on that in the baseball world at all that I've come across. So I just tried to put something together that would be helpful. And, you know, I think it was well received. So, you know, I can thank you for helping with that. You put in a couple good chapters in there that I knew you would do a good job of. So, you know, like I said, if you haven't read it, it's, I don't know, it's like $2 American probably. Convert it to American dollars is probably literally like $12 probably. But hey, I still stand behind a lot of what's said in there.
Yeah. People they're decent at the stress part, right? To grow, to get better, you have to stress something and then you must recover from that stress. That's how right. things grow. People are yes. decent at the stress part. They're very inadequate at the recover part. And
which is interesting because the stress part is, you know, maybe 10 hours a week if you're going hard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, exposing an high school player to 10 hours of stressful work a week is probably a lot, but think of all the other time. So, you know, if you deem that, you know, stress and recovering from that stress are equally important, but the time, you know, differences are obviously, you know, a lot different. I don't know why you wouldn't put more effort into understanding the recovery part of it. You can stress athletes a lot of ways and get away with a lot. You can't do that from a recovery standpoint necessarily. So, you know, if you don't sleep, you're not going to recover. If you, you know, if you have bad lifting form here and there and you don't do the right exercise, you're still going to get better. You're going to be, you know, you're still going to get better to a degree. But if you don't sleep, what's going to happen?
Unless you're Eugene Bleeker.
That guy is,
So there is like a very, very, very small percent of the population that has the DEC2 gene, basically a gene mutation that allows you to not sleep and be fully functional. I'm not fully convinced that he's not one of them.
Yeah.
So
I am not there. That's not me.
No, me neither.
I need my sleep. No chance.
Nope. I'm going to put you on the spot. So what, in your opinion, what part of player development or the player development process do you feel like you're the weakest at?
Whew. That's a tough question. I would say I'm pretty weak at the hitting stuff for sure. And, you know, I don't do any of the hitting, but I guess I have oversight of the integration of the hitting with everything else. That is something that, like I said before, I was a terrible hitter. I, you know, I'm starting to refine, my understanding of the movement a little bit more, but, yeah, I'm pretty awful at that.
Okay. Forget what I was going to ask on that anyway. So what part of, real good. I'm a fantastic, podcast interviewer, by the way.
Yeah, I just gave you a great answer. So it's definitely not your fault.
I wish I had like a cricket noise, like to click, you know,
please don't.
Editing post-production. What resources would you recommend to others to improve either professionally, personally, in baseball, in life, whatever? And that could be books, that could be events, that could be whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, obviously attending conferences like what you're putting on is, you know, that's been invaluable for me in the baseball world for sure. You know, being able to speak at a few different conferences, getting outside of Canada and doing that, meeting new people. Like I said before, I think that, you know, going to those things is not necessarily what you pick up there, although you will pick up some good information. To me, you know, what I try to present on is not necessarily the information per se. It's trying to get people to, you know, maybe spark plug a new question or a new line of thought for them. So when I go to these things, I always come away with a few questions or things that, you know, I'm like, okay, I got to go look into that a little bit more. I won't remember exactly what you said at your presentation at Bridge the Gap, but, I will take away, okay, you know what? I really need to go look into, you know, scapular mechanics a little bit more and how that relates to my assessment on the table. And, you know, those sorts of things always come out of going to conferences, but so do, you know, meeting new people and having a network. And it comes back to, you know, who influences you. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously social media is good in that sense, to a degree, depending on, you know, who your circle is, who you're actually following. But, you know, connecting with people who are growth-minded, have the same sort of passion and who are at these conferences, those relationships are where I learn from. You know, it's picking your brain about what you're looking into, what I'm looking into, you know, trying to falsify my beliefs and my theories, and me doing the same thing with you. And, a lot of that is, directs my learning. And, you know, after that, it's not going online and reading a blog post about, you know, trying to solidify my understanding of something. It's going to the research, thinking critically, going to a whiteboard by myself and trying to map things out. I think, you know, obviously we live in an era where it's really easy to, you know, get information, but, you know, filtering that out is, you know, what takes someone from being, you know, refined in their thought process and having some sort of understanding versus, you know, just throwing crap at the wall and, you know, posting it on Instagram or Twitter. So, you know, to me, you know, getting out to conferences, and I hate to toot your own horn, but getting out to, you know, like, you know, the World Pitching Congress, getting out to something like that and, you know, getting some ideas for some of those presenters. I mean, I'm really excited to learn from those people, and, you know, to have my biases questioned and, grow a network and, you know, have conversations with, new people and have conversations with guys like you and, hopefully put me on a different line of thought. So I don't think the answer to getting better as a coach, necessarily is by just, you know, scouring Twitter for the latest drill and, Instagram for a video and a blog post. Although there is good content out there, the best way to do it is to reach out to, you know, people who are in your field and having conversations with them. You know, I don't get anything out of a 180 character tweet for the most part, or however many characters are on Twitter. I don't know, but you don't get anything out of that because there's no context, and that's why everything gets misconstrued. So, you know, to me, having conversations with people is always a great way to go. And then, just sitting in a room and thinking about it yourself is I think it's something we all probably need to do a hell of a lot more. And it's something I've started to practice over the last couple months that, has really been beneficial. So there you go. There's my answer.
I like that answer.
Next.
Yeah. Next. No, but that's true though, because you might see or follow someone on social media, and once you meet them in person, you're like, that's a totally different human being than what I thought. And they actually think way more clearly and more rationally than what they come off as. And
exactly.
That's important, because even though you're not having personal conversations with them before this, if that's what you're perceiving that their context and what their thoughts are, and just the tone of what they're saying, you might take that onto the field as a coach, as a trainer, you know what I mean? And then you meet them personally, like, oh, no, you don't do that at all. That's a terrible thing to do. But you don't know.
It happens. It happens all the time. All the time. And it happens both ways. I mean, you'll meet people that,
yeah, don't meet your heroes.
You know, you're like, ooh, okay. Probably never talking to that guy again. But it happens all the time. Where I think just things always get taken out of context. There's a lot of ego and, you know, bravado online that, it comes with, you know, being followed and getting likes and retweets, and there's just no context to it. And it's really hard to provide context. And I think that's fair and understandable. So, Yeah, that's, again, like, really a big reason why I love going to these conferences. And it's just being able to talk to people and, you know, actually seeing what they're about, because, you know, sometimes you'll meet someone and, you know, they seem like one way online and then they're a completely different person, or maybe they're, you know, their knowledge base is way above or way below what you thought it would be. So, you know, like I said, you got to filter things out. You got to filter out information. Twitter, baseball Twitter, can be a dumpster fire at times. Sometimes it can be great. I think a lot of the time, you know, people should probably not take it so seriously, but, you know, it's just ego driven. You know, it'd be an interesting experiment if you took away how many followers or how many likes, all those things away from Twitter, and you just had, you know, the platform itself, it would be interesting to see how much ego is actually involved.
Just content. Yeah, that'd be fascinating.
That would be pretty interesting to see what happens. But anyways, that's my thought on it.
Cool. So I actually remembered, it came back to me, what I was going to say after the hitting with the worst part or weakest part of player development. You actually have a decent knowledge in skill acquisition, motor control, some of that. Like, you've presented on that in the past, and you have, you know, a little bit of a background in that. And I don't think many people know that about you as well.
Yeah. I think that that whole ball kind of started again with functional range systems and, you know, Mike Chivers. But yeah, I got into, you know, dynamic systems theory, I guess, before it was cool. Before it was cool and trendy. And, you know, that led me down, you know, all the different routes that kind of come with understanding movement and understanding skill. And, you know, I was on a Rob Gray in 2000, and I think his podcast, the first one that came out, but I was reading his research before Rob Gray was awesome. He was always awesome, obviously, but before he was, you know, widely regarded as a baseball expert. And this is, again, why I think it's really important to go to research, because Rob Gray, if he didn't start a podcast, you know, I hate to say it to him, but he wouldn't be as well known. And that would be really unfortunate, because, you know, he is one of the world's leading expert in skill acquisition in baseball. And nobody really knew that even while he was pumping out papers. So,
but you do get a chance to hear from him at the World Pitching Congress this year.
you absolutely do. It'll be the first time I get to meet him in person, so that'd be nice. But yeah, I think it's an interesting thing to go down. I think we're getting better as a community in understanding movement and understanding, you know, skill acquisition, and you know, people are going down the right path. So it's pretty cool to see. But yeah, I guess I wouldn't say I'm an early adopter. That sounds audacious and silly, but you know, I've been reading it for a while. It's interesting. It really is. You know, understanding how people move and understanding you know, the motor control component of it, and trying to relate that, for me, it's trying to relate that and link that to strength and conditioning and therapy and, you know, performance therapy stuff that we've talked about a lot, and then obviously picking up and refining you know, skill. So it all comes down to movement. It all comes down to trying to understand how people acquire movement and people refine and change movement, which should, you know, put you on that path eventually to reading some of that stuff. So for me, it had nothing to do really with baseball at the beginning. It was just trying to understand movement.
The brain's perception of what's going on and what it has to do to complete a task is fascinating, and it's overwhelming. Like, the smallest move, maneuver, whatever, has so many components to it, and people don't appreciate that. And, you know, understanding a little bit about the concepts of skill acquisition and adapting to imposed demands and stressors and the whole dynamic systems type theory, as well as, you know, and I'm kind of getting into a roundabout question about being a performance therapist, but like, knowing, you know, what tissue needs to respond and how it's going to respond and how the brain's going to overcompensate and what, you know, how your development led you to having these compensations and breakdowns. And it's fascinating. There's a lot to it, but like, that's why I think like someone like what you're doing and kind of along the same lines of what I'm able to do with like being a performance therapist in baseball is in my opinion, the next big thing. Because there's a lot of components there that people aren't respecting necessarily. I think once that gets out, it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, I think you know, like you just said, wow, unpacking movement and you know, the central nervous system's involvement. Yeah, how we move is incredibly complex, and you know, I this is part of what I've talked about in the past is, you know, it is one of the it's the most complicated thing. Probably human behavior and movement is probably the most complicated thing on the planet, especially when you're talking about one of the fastest movements in the planet with throwing a baseball. You know, we try to solve it with simplicity, and you know, that's it's one thing to take complexity and try to understand it and whittle down complexity to simplicity. It's another thing to just completely neglect how complex the whole thing is to begin with, and just providing simple solutions just because it's simple and that's all you can comprehend. The challenge to me and what I wake up and gets me through the day, honestly, is, you know, how much more there is to learn, how little I know, you know, how unsure I should be, and, you know, the excitement of figuring things out. I've said this to you 1,000 times, like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't think anyone does, really. No. They don't really have a clue. I mean, anyone who talks about, you know, injury and preventing injuries and mitigating injury risk, we're terrible at that. We really are. I mean, and if you just cut away, you know, the stupid stuff, the low hanging fruit, great. That's great. We can all do that. But after that, do we really understand how to mitigate injury risk substantially? I don't think we do. I don't think we have a good understanding of how to do that necessarily. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess, you know, when I think about, you know, complexity and I think about, you know, outcomes and, you know, controlling outcomes, you know, I kind of get away from that. So, you know, I don't put a lot of stock in success or failures necessarily. I try to refine my process. You know, you're dealing with a complex system, right? So you're not going to have predictable outcomes. You're not going to have control of outcomes. Things happen that are unexpected. That's kind of what complexity is all about. So, you know, you're going to have guys who get better and you did a lot of things wrong. But if you only go off of, hey, the guy got better, I'm the man, you're not learning. You're not getting better at what you do. If you do everything right or you do a lot of things right relative to what you did a year ago, but you have a guy, you know, undergo a UCL rupture and you just go by the UCL rupture, again, like it's not a learning point for you. It's not a definitive, you know, something that you definitively controlled. So, complexity is a whole different topic. I think it's fascinating to go down those rabbit holes, and you know, for me, being a performance therapist is, you know, I guess this is somewhat unrelated, but you know, it's problem solving every step of the way, and it's connecting dots more than anything else. So, you know, the way that I see, you know, performance therapy and the way that we do it here is it's just manipulating internal constraints. And, you know, getting your hands on people and seeing how the body adapts to stressors and trying to open things up or understand why things are the way that they are and see how they're adapting to things. And, yeah, I think, like I said before, you can get a lot of feedback from your hands if you're, you know, in tune with it and you're really paying attention. And, if you do that consistently, you know, on a day-to-day basis with the guy, you can learn a lot of things and, you get a really good sense of who they are, as an organism and how they're responding to stuff. And you can also manipulate them and, you know, how they move or, you know, remove some of the internal constraints of how they could move, without actually talking to them. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's like the best external cue ever. If you can just open up something momentarily and then get their body to explore a different, you know, space, a solution space for a task. So that's how I see it. We look at it from not just a, you know, a health standpoint, you know, and there are obvious things with that, but we look at it from a skill acquisition standpoint. So, you know, how can we get someone on the table and manipulate their internal constraints to, you know, their structural constraints or their, you know, how they're moving to solve a task a different way or a way that we'd want them to, or, you know, expedite the learning process. So, I think performance therapy is, it's probably, I'm going to talk about that probably at the conference. Where and how I go with it, I'm not really sure yet. It's going to get refined, but that's what we're going to talk about. I think it's, like you said, it's uncharted territories in baseball for the most part. Predominantly the history of baseball is if you're on the table, you're either hurt or you're hiding that you're hurt and you're lying to someone. So I think that has to change. It's going to change because, you've seen it. You see it every day and I see it every day. There's an incredible amount of value to be had from having someone integrated directly into the skill portion of it and the performance portion of it, and having a therapist who could speak the same language as a coach, as a strength coach, and be able to coach themselves on both fronts. So I think that's kind of going to be the next wave is having the therapist integrated. I think the wave after that will be, someone who can do that and manipulate stuff with their hands, but can also coach, whether it's strength and conditioning. You kind of see it leaking already, right? You see strength conditioning coaches to, manipulate internal constraints, whether it's foam rolling or, some soft tissue stuff that they're not necessarily allowed to say they do, but they do. Same thing with coaches. And you see it all the time, and you see it because it's effective and it works. And I think that's kind of where baseball will eventually go. It's going to go towards where there's value. And, I think it's obviously, we're not the only two people in the world doing it. There are people out there doing it. There's little pockets of people who are doing it. And that's only going to grow.
I agree. And I think there's going to be more people like what you and I do that will be like co-pitching coaches with the actual pitching coach,
That's
like
right.
The pitching coach is the one that kind of dictates what goes on in the game and the pitching strategy. And, when you use a certain guy here and all that and the, approach you're going to have for hitters, but then he needs somebody that can help him whenever the pitcher doesn't feel right or the pitcher is off or, the curveball is not moving as much here. Well, it's because he has less spine angle and his release is off and his spin axis is off because he had a rough day yesterday or he slipped and fell when something went, weird, or he's just not moving well that day and he needs some form of, whether it's a manipulation, myofascial release, some type of stability, some type of intervention that someone that also understands movement and pitching can help him with.
100%. And, like I said, it's just movement, understanding we're all reading similar things or we should be reading and growing and going towards similar things. And I 100% agree with you on that. So, what I do and where I am, I get to be the hands-on guy and the pitching coach at the same time, which is, fascinating and it's problem solving. It's a lot of fun. But I definitely see that being a thing. I think it only makes sense. It'll happen until we get to a point where someone can do both.
Yep.
And, regulations are changed, I don't see a pitching coach being able to manipulate someone. Having that therapist, that someone who can, get their hands on someone and give you feedback as a coach it's there, man. It's going to happen.
Yeah. So a couple more things, then we'll get off here. So, just cause we're hour and 20 minutes in already.
Oh, no one's making it past 40 minutes.
We lost people at 25 minutes. So you had an event this year. Tell more about that. Your showcase.
Oh, okay. So we, like I said before, the exposure thing, we decided to, flip the equation a little bit and, try to have a showcase event where we actually had coaches come up here. So, about a month ago, we had a showcase that was, put on in conjunction with Rawlings and Flatground app. And we basically decided to, offer, pretty lengthy assessment process for the players. So, you sign up, you go through a physical assessment, you go through a strength conditioning assessment, you go through a skill assessment, and then you have the showcase part of it where we had some college coaches come up. We had about, 24 college coaches total who were there, and we had 10 who were instructing So we basically split up in two, and we got rained out, so we had to do it indoors, which kind of sucked. But we had some live at-bats, you know, for the top players, and then everyone else got to go through an instructional component where, you know, they threw a bullpen with a couple D1 pitching coaches, or they did some hitting work with a couple D1 hitting coaches. And then at the end of it, they got some feedback from the assessment process. So, you know, we gave them feedback on, you know, some of the, you know, movement limitations or weaknesses on that end, what they should do about it, some recommendations. We gave them some feedback in terms of their strength and conditioning testing, you know, where they lined up with, you know, guys that we've seen either, you know, in the pro ranks, high school draft pick rank or college rank. And then we gave them some feedback on their performance metrics as well. So we gave them a lot of feedback. And, you know, the idea was really to, you know, you go to a showcase typically, you know, if you do well or you show that you're good enough, you'll get feedback from coaches and coaches are going to come and talk to you, right? But what happens if you don't? Yeah. So for us, we wanted to give players, you know, a little bit extra. So, you know, if you know, you got a bunch of views and we got a lot of views to our profiles, if you didn't get any feedback from coaches, you didn't have coaches reach out to you, at least you're coming away with a bit of a plan, a bit of some objective information about this is what we found in players who are where you want to be. These are some of the things that we think you need to work on. So we put it on. We got 70 kids signed up. We had a few kids drop out because of travel, sickness, or injury. But, you know, we ended up running around 65 kids run through here, did all the assessment stuff. Everything went really well. And then I think I haven't checked in the last week, but, you know, we leveraged Flat Ground to help get, you know, the word out and to get coaches to look at the profiles. And we had about 10,000 views, player views in the first 24 hours, which
nice.
Is incredible. Yeah.
Shout out Pitching Ninja.
Yeah. Thank you, Pitching Ninja and Rob. And yeah, I think it was an awesome event. You know, it was a lot of work on our end, but you know, we wanted to get rid of that excuse, at least for Canadian players, that, you know, we didn't get exposure or we never got in front of a coach. I think we did a good job of it. There's obviously things we can do better, but for the first time running it, I think we did a pretty good job.
That's awesome. That sounds exactly like what Canadian baseball needed. Something to just kind of get their feet wet, understand what they really need to be doing.
Yeah, well, I think everyone needs that, right? So, you know, some players are already getting that, and that's great. A lot of players aren't getting any objective feedback, even at the major league level or the minor league level, right? You have your minor league guys come back, and what are you working on this winter? Oh, I'm supposed to work on my slider. What else? Like, give me some numbers. Give me some – oh, that's it. Okay, well, like, that's not really helpful, but sure.
That's so true.
It's true. It's very true. You know, so obviously we're getting better at that. But yeah, the overwhelming majority of high school baseball players in Ontario do not get feedback on assessments. So for, I would say, 99% of the players that we had, this is the first time they've gotten a piece of paper. This is exactly what, you know, where they are, what they say, what kind of metrics they had relative to where they want to go, stuff like that. So I think it was great.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. You're a new dad.
Yes, I am.
What? So total life-changing event. How has that affected, or not affected, I should say, how has that changed the way you approach your professional life and the way you approach just being a human being?
Priorities.
Yes.
That's spot on. It really does lights a fire under your ass in a number of different directions. You know, the first obviously is, you know, taking care of the baby and your wife and your family.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's doing everything I possibly can to be in a position that I can spend as much time as possible with my family. So it lights a fire under your ass to be more productive, you know, to do podcasts on a Thursday morning at 10 a.m. and paint a plyo wall at 8 a.m. And, you know, it lights a fire in your ass just to get your priorities straight. And, you know, I think it's one of the few things. And I've said this to pretty much anyone who's asked me this question. It's one of the few things, if not the only thing, really, that has lived up to the hype.
Yeah, that's really spot on. That's actually, that's a really good way to put it. You had a girl, correct?
I had a boy.
Boy? Okay, are we going to be pushing baseball at all, or is this going to be, let's see where he goes?
I'm not pushing him anything, not at all.
that's smart.
Yeah, definitely not. Just see what he does.
It's amazing how now, like, when you have an hour of like nothing technically scheduled, how you want to just totally, you know, be as productive as possible so that you have time elsewhere with family and with all, you know, it's wild.
1,000,000%.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to do something crazy in baseball or research or all that, and they're not married, they don't have a kid, like, you better be hammering and appreciating every second you have, because it is limited.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It goes bye-bye. Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, you actually answered my last question on the teaser for what you're going to talk about at the World Pigeon Congress with the whole, performance therapist thing. So you covered that for me already.
Yeah, perfect.
Any last thoughts, concerns, something you want to get off your chest?
No. It was fun doing this, obviously. I think it's going to be a great event. And, you know, I obviously encourage people to go to it, just to meet people and again, to open up new lines of thought and, you know, hopefully have an adult beverage or two with me and, maybe call me out in some BS and vice versa and just expand your network. So, I'm really excited to be there and meet some new people and listen to the other presenters for sure. But yeah, if you're not signed up, you should. For sure. The lineup is unbelievable. Yeah, it really is. So if you're involved in baseball in any capacity, you know, as a therapist, like, the lineup is incredible. It, like, you know, if there was something like this when I was in chiropractic school, I would 1,000,000% be there. So it's great. Kudos to you guys for doing it, you and Brett.
I'm excited for it. I'm so looking forward to this. It's going to be a blast. Well,
yeah.
Steve, we will, I'm sure we'll talk soon, but in person, I'll see you in January.
That's right, man. We'll see you there.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Tyler.
Yep. We'll see you.
All right, boss. Bye.
And there you have it. Thanks a lot, Steve, for chatting with us today. If you want to learn more about Steve or the Baseball Development Group, you can literally check them out on any of the socials. You can also check out his book, The Baseball Recovery Resource. I may or may not have had something to do with that. You can also meet him in person here in St. Louis, Missouri in January at the World Pigeon Congress. Learn from him, meet him, hear what they have to do in baseball up in Canada, all the above. So we will see you there. If you're a player or coach and you're looking for a more efficient way to warm up, check out our free Dynamic Warm-Up ebook. This warm-up consists of evidence-based movements revolved around neuromuscular stability and fascial slings. You can download it off of our website, or just go to the Gestalt Performance Twitter page and follow the link.